My mind is a raging torrent, flooded with rivulets of thought, cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives.
Now don't tell me you're taking all this seriously.
First of all, let's give it up to God. With him, all things are possible.
What are you, crazy?
Welcome to War Machine, a podcast for theological nomads. A few weeks ago, I spoke with John Opsipais, who is a magician, scholar, and computer scientist, who's practiced magic, divination, and neo-paganism since the 60s. He has more than 40 publications in various magical and neo-pagan magazines, and designed the Pythagorean Tarot, and wrote the comprehensive guide to that tarot deck. He's also author of The Oracles of Apollo and The Secret Texts of Hellenic Polytheism. There's plenty to say, I think, about our conversation, but I'll only say that I think things sort of get more interesting as we go along. So I hope you enjoy the discussion. If anyone wants to read the first chapter of the book that we reference in this conversation, which is called Pythagorean Theology and the Esoteric Elements, John has made that available over on his website. I'll link to that in the show notes. And if you like what you hear or read, get the book. We're at warmachinepodcast.com. Here is John Apollonius Opsipais. Hey, John.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Is that a real background or a virtual one?
That's a virtual background.
Well, it's lovely. Where are you hoping that you are rather than where you are?
Sintra in Portugal.
Okay. Have you been there before?
Yeah, I have. I took that picture, actually.
Nice. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me about your work. My friend Emery, who has some familiarity with these sorts of topics, I invited him to join, so he may jump in at some point. But I'm just going to go ahead on the assumption that it's just us. Honestly, I can't remember how I first became aware of this book that you've written on Pythagorean theology and the esoteric elements. I think maybe a friend posted about it online and it seemed interesting and I tracked you down. Obviously, I want to talk about the ideas in the book, which I think are very interesting, but I'm sort of curious. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about you. Is it right that you live in Tennessee?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Eastern Tennessee.
Born and raised?
No. I've been here, almost 40 years now, but okay. No, I was born up in New Jersey.
Oh, that's where I am.
California for a number of years. I was up in Bergen County, up in the northeast corner of New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in the Montclair area, if you know where that is.
Yeah.
Not too far. I was curious about that because I have family from Tennessee, and I know something about the state. When I think about these kinds of esoteric things, I don't think of Tennessee.
Yeah.
so it makes more sense that you originated somewhere else. But I don't know. Did you grow up in a religious home? I'm curious how you got interested in things like magic, theurgy, and things like this. How did that all come together for you? What was that like initial?
Yeah, so I did not grow up in a religious home. I mean, my parents were nominally Christian, but very, very rarely went to church. And so I wasn't brought up in a strongly religious environment. My background was more scientific, but I did have an interest in more esoteric topics when I was probably back to middle school. You know, I started studying folklore and I was interested in magic and actually started compiling, you know, from various sorts of sources that I was able to read, mostly folklore sources, sort of a book of shadows kind of thing. Then later in high school, I became more interested in Gurdjieff and Uspensky and some of their work. So I was investigating those kinds of things at that time. But quite a bit later, I'd say probably around the late 70s or early 80s, since my grad school days, I was very interested, or before really, actually back to high school, I was very interested in ancient Greek culture. So ancient Greek philosophy, especially literature and art. And say roughly around 1980, I kind of realized, you know, in some sense, I'm more at home in this belief system than I am in any of the contemporary ones. And so I had that experience that so many people that in the neo-pagan community have of coming home. It's kind of like waking up one day and realizing, well, gee, I guess I'm really a pagan, then identifying with that belief system. And I'd been aware of neo-pagans in grad school, so it wasn't like a big shock that there were other people around that were practicing religious practices or spiritual practices that could be considered neo-pagan. And so it was really just kind of a realizing that that was probably the path that I was sort of naturally falling into anyway. And so I started studying it more systematically. I learned more about what other neo-pagans were doing, and in particular neo-pagans that were more interested in the Greek pantheon. Of course, that fit in very well with my interest in ancient Greek philosophy. So I just began studying. Like I said, I'm a scientist by background, but I started studying the work of various scholars in the area to learn what to do and to sort of craft my own spiritual path out of that. The way I define neo-paganism, it's based in ancient practices, but evolved into the modern world, you know, how more appropriately for our culture and our understanding today. And so that's what I've tried to do, is understand what ancient philosophers and others were studying and doing, and then adapt it to the modern world.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's two things in there I wanted to pick up on. You made use of the term pagan, and I'm mm-hmm. perfectly happy to, I know what you mean by that. But I understand that for some people, this can be a contentious term. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, in origin, it's a pejorative term. When Christianity became dominant in the Roman Empire, the people that still worshipped the old traditional religion, the polytheistic religion, were paganos. They were, you know, the country bumpkins, essentially. And so that's where we get our term pagan. But I think that just like queer people have reappropriated the term queer, and witches have reappropriated the term witch, I think it's quite appropriate for modern day followers of those old polytheistic traditions to reappropriate the term pagan. But I understand a lot of people have trouble with it. And, you know, when you talk about neo-pagan too, people kind of can have problems with that also. It's like, well, you know, this is not neo, this is the old religion. Yeah. I think it's appropriate to basically say, no, I'm not, you know, sacrificing cattle like people did back then. I'm doing an appropriately modern version of these ancient practices. So, you know, and then you get into all sort of issues about, well, is this reconstruction or is it blah, 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 blah. And, you know, those are all interesting and good conversations. But yeah, so I normally just identify myself as neo-pagan because if nothing else, it sort of puts a stake in the ground that we can then talk about, you know, what exactly that means.
Yeah, I agree with that. I try to avoid those kinds of, when the conversation around terminology gets to be overly technical, it's just like, okay, we're not really talking about anything interesting much anymore. So I'm happy to kind of leave it at that. But I know that it's really important for people. Some people, I just want to ask you about that. The other thing in there was you were talking about your scientific background, and I'm curious about that on its own, what kind of science you were interested in, what kind of field you were working in, and then also that exploration of, let's just say, paganism, for lack of a better word. I wonder if, or to what extent, that sort of scientific, I don't know, mindset or methodology or what have you, to what extent that was brought to bear on that exploration and how you think about that sort of thing.
Yeah. So my background undergraduate was physics and mathematics. Graduate was computer science, although I really started that actually as an undergraduate also. So it's really computer science is my sort of principal area. Within computer science, I was interested in what you might consider the more philosophical aspects of it. So the theory of computation, linguistics, I was interested in and I studied some linguistics in graduate school, and intelligence, artificial intelligence. So I was interested in the cognitive aspects of computer science, and then that included artificial intelligence. The work I did in computer science often wandered around in the intersection between philosophy, especially philosophy of mind, but also epistemology, and psychology, again, focusing on cognition, but also other aspects of psychology as well. And, you know, I did some work in artificial life communicating. So it gets into issues of intentionality. You know, when can you say an artificial organism has some sort of original intentionality? And so I had to learn a lot about those topics as well to do the sort of computer science work I did. So, I mean, in one sense, this work was really sort of mostly independent of my religious practice or my spiritual practice, but they eventually kind of grew together. So, and this is where, you know, Neoplatonism and Pythagoreanism comes in too, because that has the kind of mathematical aspect and the logical aspect, but it's also a very deep spiritual tradition. Over the years, my pagan practice kind of evolved from essentially a reconstruction of ancient practices to something that's more strictly Neoplatonic. That's when it starts to kind of merge into my scientific background as well, because, I mean, that was kind of the science of the day too. And so what I've tried to do is try and understand what were the Neoplatonists talking about and what were they experiencing, and try and understand that from a modern perspective, because we have learned a lot of things. We've learned a lot of things about psychology. We've learned a lot of things about cosmology and philosophy, for that matter. And so I try and bring that more contemporary understanding back to the spiritual experiences that the Neoplatonists were having, because I think that that's something that's missing from a lot of our modern scientific worldview, is that there's no coherent spiritual practice that goes with it. So I think Neoplatonism is in many ways best able to provide that.
That's interesting. I guess that's not really something that I've considered. On one hand, I definitely understand what you're saying. On the other hand, science, as I understand it, assumes a certain metaphysic that would be, I think, somewhat at odds with Neoplatonism. No?
Well, yes, you're right. And I think, you know, what you might consider the overall background of assumptions behind science is essentially materialistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, then you look at, for instance, fundamental physics, and it's Pythagorean, right? It's basically saying what's real are these mathematical relationships, and everything in the material world follows from these mathematical relationships. You know, there's Wheeler's idea of it from bit. You know, the basic, right. There's nothing left except the mathematics when you actually distill it all down. And that's a very Pythagorean view and a very Neoplatonic view. You've got these logical relationships or mathematical relationships that in some way, which I don't think we understand, emanates the material world and is behind the material world. In that sense, I would say a very Pythagorean worldview, and Neoplatonism is basically a development of Pythagoreanism. So that's very, very, that's fundamental stuff. That's far removed from everyday life.
Right.
When it gets to things that are closer to our lives, you know, sort of the traditional truth, beauty, and justice type of things, then I think we have to take a more psychological approach. My interpretation is that there's still not necessarily eternal, but there's very long-lasting principles behind our psychology. These things evolve, but they don't change very quickly. These principles are behind human psychology, and so they are effectively eternal forms of behavior and of psychological structure that I think the Neoplatonists were experiencing, and they assumed, because they didn't know about evolution, they assumed these things were just this way forever, like the mathematical relationships. And so they put them in the same category. Well, I think they're in a little different category. They're in a category of public, long-lasting cognitive structures that are common to all human beings. And that's where I put the gods, for example. You know, I take a Jungian kind of perspective on them, that these are archetypal structures in our subconscious, common to all human beings, that have not changed much in the last several hundred thousand years. That's where, although that's scientific, in my opinion, that we've got lots of scientific evidence for that, to interact with those structures is where we need the spiritual tools that the theurgists developed, or the Neoplatonists developed, including theurgy, for example. That's a very effective way for us to interact with these parts of our unconscious.
I want to return to the thing you were saying about it from bit, because there's an interesting cybernetic overlay here that I think will be interesting to explore. But to return to the fundamentals of this book and of Pythagorean theology, I think it would be helpful to just start with some basics. As I was reading this, it occurred to me that maybe this term Pythagorean theology is a little bit misleading, in the sense that there's, as you write, there's not an orthodox or, you know, standard formulation of this, and that there could be a broad range of differences across geographies or time. And so what you're doing, as I understand it, is something of a synthesis here. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, in some sense, it does not claim to be a scholarly study of Pythagoreanism. So Pythagoras wrote nothing down, as far as we know. And
oral tradition.
Yeah, an oral tradition, which is kind of what you would expect for what Pythagoreanism was. I mean, Pythagoras was a guru, and he had this community that he led. We have later Pythagorean writings. Some of them are attributed to Pythagoras, but again, this was a common practice to attribute your writings to the master, you know. So yeah, we don't have a definitive body of text that we can really call Pythagorean. So what do we have? Well, we have these later Pythagorean and Neo-Pythagorean texts that purport to be within this tradition. We know that Pythagoras was very influential indirectly on Plato. So the Timaeus is basically filled with Pythagorean ideas. And we can talk about what might constitute Pythagorean ideas. And, you know, there's also references, some of Socrates' friends and acquaintances, we have reason to believe, were Pythagoreans, and some of those ideas enter into the other dialogues as well. Now, then the later Platonists, they were, again, ringing these same bells that have a Pythagorean sound to them. Numenius, for example, Plutarch, but then the strict Neoplatonists such as Porphyry wrote a life of Pythagoras. You know, so this was part of the standard Neoplatonic curriculum. It basically starts with a life of Pythagoras. So again, they viewed themselves as being in this tradition. Iamblichus also wrote a life of Pythagoras. So he was really viewed as, in some sense, although they went back to Plato because they had texts from Plato.
Right.
But in some sense, they saw themselves as being in this same Pythagorean tradition. So what does that mean? Well, it means a spiritual life. So Pythagoras taught this practice that had implications for how you live, how states are run, and of course, a cosmological view. We know that numbers were very important to Pythagoras. Numbers were in some sense deities. And that is what I try and especially bring out in my book. And so that, again, remained a common thread throughout all of the through Plato, and then also through the later Neoplatonists as well. And so what I've tried to do in the book is looking at all of these things. So the whole Platonic tradition from Plato up through the Neoplatonists, also the mythological tradition. So we find Pythagoras is apparently influenced by the Orphic tradition. And so I look at the Orphic literature as well as that. And I try and bring together all of these things that, to my mind, they make a coherent picture. That's what I've intended to put together in that book. So it is a synthesis. You know, you might even call it a creative synthesis. You know, it's all based on scholarly work, but the connections are in many cases intuitive connections. And some of them are through the use of numbers as well. So this is kind of my understanding of what sort of a coherent system of doctrines or beliefs through this whole thing might look at. But again, it can't claim to, I can't claim to have textual evidence for all of these connections, for example.
Right. And you're clear when you're doing something more constructive in the book. So
I try to be.
Yeah, it's certainly appreciated.
And that's really been my approach to all of the work I do in broadly speaking in neo-pagan practice, is we don't have enough stuff from the ancients. The evidence is incomplete. But I look at the evidence we've got. I look at what scholars who have the expertise have concluded from the evidence. And then I try and make clear where I'm filling in the gaps, either from parallel traditions or just out of my own creativity, really.
Right. I appreciate that. And here, as with other kinds of traditions, I think trying to retrieve some, you know, unadulterated primitive version of it is kind of a fool's errand anyway, unless, you know, that's your thing and you're, you know, trying to do some sort of like heavy academic lifting. But there's something in there you mentioned about how Pythagoras was involved in like things like statecraft and organizing societies and things like that. And before we get into some of the more esoteric stuff, I want to kind of maybe put this up front. Like, I can imagine people listening in and wondering what bearing this has on things like ethics or politics, which I think is a fair question. So what's your understanding of that?
Well, I think, you know, that the central point here is the point that Pierre Hadot made in a number of his books, that ancient philosophy was a way of life. We think of it as an academic discipline, you know, very technical issues in epistemology and ontology and so forth. But ancient philosophy was a way of life. What ancient philosophers were teaching you was how to live better. So that's how to live better on a personal level, you know, just how do you deal with being a good human being and dealing with what happens in life. But then also at the family level, you know, how do you manage your family? So that's, in ancient terms, economics. It's the management of the oikos, the house. And then at the social level. So how do you manage a state? You know, so of course, Plato's Republic, Plato's laws, the idea of a philosopher king that comes out of Plato. So it was in the broader terms of how would you manage a state? And of course, philosophers were sometimes advisors to rulers, you know, so they would either in their education, as Aristotle with Alexander, or with Plato also, that they would be advisors to the leaders of the state. So if you view this from that perspective, that these were wise men and women, but, you know, often my wise men are the ones we know about, that were supposed to be providing general advice about how the world is and how we should live in it. Now, the other thing is, there's a lot of evidence for spiritual practices that Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans did that we would typically call shamanic now. So in other words, journeying to some spiritual realm where the gods were, where they could find things out, or in fact, directly intervene in how things were happening in the world, curing plagues, that sort of thing, or finding out what needed to be done religiously. You know, oh, you need to sacrifice to so-and-so for this, or you've offended the gods because you did such and such. And so that kind of oracular wisdom as well, that was something that Pythagoras was known for. And also the other philosophers, Empedocles, for example, all of the pre-Socratic philosophers really had this reputation of not just being wise people, smart people, we might say, but having these skills that allowed them to interact directly with the gods and therefore bring important information to the society as a whole. And Pythagoras led his Pythagoreans to Italy, where they set up colonies, where they reorganized the political systems that were in use. And this is ultimately what got them into trouble, because, of course, when you start doing that stuff, you get a lot of enemies.
Right.
The old guard in particular. That was kind of their mission, if we want to put it in those terms, was to go and help other Greek colonies, especially in Italy, to reorganize themselves better. So this is why what Plato does, you know, much later, is really right in line with what Pythagoras was already doing. and the others, you know, not just Pythagoras, but Parmenides and Empedocles. All of these people had this sort of larger mission of how humans should be living on Earth.
Yeah. And for me, that just, it raises this idea that, quote unquote, corrupting the youth isn't just like some kind of edgy catchphrase, right? It's a well thought out strategy to reform society. And, you know, you were talking about the shamanic aspects of some of these figures, and some of the activities that you were describing them as performing sounded a lot like magical activities, divination. You mentioned the oracular element. Mm-hmm. Would those things always have gone together in those times? I'm curious about where magic sort of maps onto this discussion.
Right. Well, of course, magic comes from magos, the Persian priestly caste. In ancient Greece, that term had a distinctly religious tone to it. These were the Eastern, especially Persian, religious leaders that reformed religion, but also were the experts on religious practice. And by religious, I mean anything of that sort. So oracular, divination, but also advising the leaders, because, you know, religion infused life in the ancient world. You didn't start a war without first consulting the oracles. So these were the specialists that knew how to do this stuff. And I think ancient philosophy in, say, the Greek world was always coming from this foundation. The pre-Socratics all had this magical aspect about them. We know this from the biographies of them, that they were supposed to work miracles. They're known for working miracles. And often the miracles were things like stopping plagues. You know, they were very practical sorts of stuff, but also advising the leaders and interpreting oracles. So yeah, so what Socrates is doing, of course, his whole life was in response to this oracle that said he was the wisest of men. And, you know, in his sort of ironical way, he said, well, he's pretty stupid, you know, what does the god mean by this? So trying to interpret the oracle. You know, Pythagoras, one of the biographies says that his mother went to the Delphic oracle to ask about her pregnancy and basically was told that her unborn child was a child of Apollo. And that's why she named him Pythagoras, you know, led by the Pythian. So there's this story already that Pythagoras is not only a holy person, but he's actually an offspring of one of the principal gods who was central to Pythagoreanism. I think, you know, what we might consider philosophy as a purely intellectual pursuit, especially a purely rational pursuit, that is much later rewriting of the ancient philosophical tradition. And this is why Pierre Hadot's claim, based on evidence, obviously, that ancient philosophy was a way of life was so important, but in a sense revolutionary, because, you know, people look at Parmenides as, you know, the founder of modern logic. Well, you read Parmenides' poem, it's a shamanic journey. You know, he's recounting a shamanic journey to the goddess of the underworld. And so it's really from a sort of an Enlightenment era rewriting of all of this history and neglecting all of the stuff that doesn't fit, which included really the whole Neoplatonic tradition. You know, this was considered, oh, yeah, philosophy was dead, really, beginning with Plotinus. It went off in this mystical direction that's not really philosophy anymore. But that's from our much more modern understanding of what philosophy is. And it's not the ancient understanding. The ancient understanding, you know, if we think about Eastern gurus, that much more like what philosophy was understood to be. Look at the Dalai Lama. It's a spiritual tradition. He's a head of state. He consults oracles. You know, I think that the closest modern analog to what was going on in the ancient world with their philosophers.
Nice. Maybe we can just at this point, like, shift directions a little bit. Because I wanted to, maybe we can get a little bit nerdier for a little bit. I wanted to talk about theogony and the birth of the gods in this, in this system. And as a way into that, as a way of doing that, I wonder if maybe we could use the image of the pentagram as you do in the book, as a way of illustrating or visualizing that process.
Well, this is where essentially the traditional view of the gods in ancient Greece and the Platonic view and Pythagoreanism all comes together in a sense. Plato is famous for, and it was a common position amongst the philosophers, that the poets tell lies about the gods. You know, all of this stuff about the incest and the castration, or just all of the squabbling amongst the gods and everything. They said, you know, those are all just lies, and they kind of breed disrespect about the gods. But nevertheless, the Neoplatonists said the gods exist. They exist in the Platonic realm of Platonic forms. So what exactly are the gods? I've got my own opinions about that from sort of a more Jungian perspective, but they said, well, these are forms within this Platonic realm. That's where the gods reside. And then, so it was very interesting then to try and figure out what was their nature. And, you know, they recognized that there were, if you like, ranks of gods and lower spirits, daimons as well. But because the gods exist in this realm of forms, which is outside of space and time, you don't have literal generations where one generation of gods gives birth to the next generation of the gods. But nevertheless, they saw a process of emanation where gods that were closer to material reality were emanated from gods that were further from material reality. So when you start investigating this from a more philosophical perspective, I think informed by their theurgical practices. So they're having direct experiences of the gods, you have to remember. They're doing these theurgical practices that cause the gods to manifest to them in various ways. And so they're having some direct experience with the gods and even can have discussions with the gods. So I think all of this philosophical thinking is informed by their experiences as well.
Right. It's a second order discourse. I mean, it is a proper theology, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. A lot of this, it really grows out of Middle Platonism, but it's some of it is there already in Plato, is that on one hand, they see that there has to be a first principle behind all of this, but they have trouble figuring out what this first principle is. You know, Plato calls it the good and the one. But Numenius seems to be maybe the one that came up with this idea that you've got this primary duality that you have to get from this one to a multiplicity of gods and to a multiplicity of everything else in the world. This is a perennial problem of the one and the many, you know, and how is the one and the many related? A principle, it goes back to the Pythagoreans, is these two principles where you've got a monad or a one. And that kind of, you know, you can kind of wrap your head around that a little bit. It's a principle of unity. And then you've got this second principle, a dyad, so a principle of duality. But the significant idea that comes is that they call this the indefinite or indeterminate dyad. So it seems to be not just a principle of two-ness, but a principle of multiplicity. So you have to have some sort of separation for there to be more than one. So it's sort of the principle of separation that allows you to have different things. And it's a very mysterious idea. You know, you start thinking about, well, what exactly does this mean for there to be multiple things? It's a very knotty philosophical problem.
Yeah, and if I can, that's sort of related to this, as I understand it, the more Empedoclean, did I say that right? Notions of strife and love as the two kind of fundamental principles. Like strife would be associated with this principle of separation or differentiation, right? And love is this unifying force.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yeah, so Empedocles said that these two forces were the primary forces in the universe. Of course, Empedocles also gave us the four elements, the four classical elements. And so these two principles were what were joining the elements together and separating them apart from each other as well. And he believed that there was sort of a cyclic process where love was, or affinity would be another way to translate it too, was dominant in some eras and everything was kind of all together in a big blob, but then strife was dominant in other eras when all of the elements would be sort of fighting with each other even and separating out into the different elements. And that there was a cyclic process that went between these two different extremes. So the Pythagoreans also, and this is again, as reported by Aristotle, essentially, had this table of opposites. So they put everything into these two columns And one of the heads really were the definite and the indefinite. Under those would be things like straight and curved, male and female, and so on. And so all things were sorted into these two categories so that there was this basic principle of duality underlying everything was really fundamental to the whole Pythagorean worldview as well. And so these are later attempts to rethink that, you know, that sort of a crude idea, and you find tables of opposites like that in many different philosophies and in many different philosophical traditions around the world. Mm-hmm. But this idea that this all stems from this monad and indefinite dyad is a later refinement of that idea. Try and sort of figure it out. What is it that makes things different? What is it that makes things opposites? So this is where the theogony comes in, is, well, if in the Pythagorean way you think of numbers as being deities and vice versa, this monad and this dyad, this one and this two, are sort of the two principal ones because they generate all of the other numbers. You can't get any numbers from just one. So you have to have this indefinite dyad to generate other numbers. And if the numbers are the gods, you have to have this monad and this indefinite dyad as sort of the first two parent gods that generate all of the rest, just like one and two generate all of the rest of the numbers. So what are they? Well, so the monad is typically considered a male god. Of course, in ancient views of sex, the male was the form-providing parent, and the mother was the matter-providing parent. You can see, you know, how those views came. But it's kind of in the back of a lot of this thinking, is that the male is the more form-providing and the female is the more matter-providing. So the female provides the multiplicity, the reproduction, you might say, and also the individual instantiation of all of these different forms. Mm-hmm. So you get then the monad and the infinite dyad as being sort of the two principal parents for all of the other gods, and arguably for all multiplicity in the universe. And then you can attach names to them. The names that are often attached and that I used were Kronos and Rhea, who are considered the parents of the gods in traditional Greek mythology. But again, you know, it's like the names are just really attempts to see in the traditional mythology some hints of this more philosophical understanding of what's going on in terms of them.
Right. They're almost placeholders for more fundamental principles that are hard to put into words and therefore esoteric.
Well, this is the issue, of course, when we're dealing at this level. I mean, the words are the monads. The indefinite dyad is what makes them separate words and relates the words together. So what we're dealing here is with something that's really more fundamental than verbal expression, than the logos. I define logos as articulated thought, whether it's articulated in language or articulated in your mind, it's articulated thought. So what we're dealing here is, if you like, the two basic principles underlying logos, okay? Because you have to have words or articulations. The indefinite dyad is what articulates them, okay? Mm-hmm. What's being articulated is the monad.
Yeah.
So yes, we're now at a level where we're more fundamental than logic, more fundamental than speech. And then, of course, the problem is of course, well, okay, but we've got two principles, right? And if we believe that there's an ultimate unity behind these principles, what is that? And that's where you get in Plotinus. It's already in Plato and in Parmenides, at least in the dialogue Parmenides, but you especially get it in the Neoplatonists that, oh, there must be a further principle of unity behind the monad and the indefinite dyad. And that's what called the one or the ineffable one, the unspeakable one.
Yeah.
To areton hen. It's literally the one that cannot be expressed. So this is explicitly an ineffable principle that cannot be adequately described in words, and so can only be experienced through the spiritual practices of the Neoplatonists.
Yeah. When I was reading about that, I couldn't help but think of the later Semitic tradition where there's a prohibition against graven images, which I sort of understood to be a prohibition against speaking of the divine apart from this ineffable character, right? Because then you're into the realm of, I guess, as they would put it, idolatry. Like for the Jewish people, the true God was the God above all gods, the one that who could not be named. And that's why they wouldn't even spell it out in full.
Yes, that I think is exactly. It's the same insight. And it's the Tao too, right?
Right,
so
right.
I think in many different traditions, they've kind of reached this same point. It is interesting talking about idolatry, though, because one of the things the Neoplatonists were known for is, quote unquote, animating statues. In other words, calling down a deity into a statue. This is important because, well, it was a very important spiritual practice for them, but because it makes clear that it's not idolatry, that they're using the statue as a medium of communication with a deity that, in fact, is not in the statue in any, you know, literal sense. I mean, because in a literal sense, deities are outside of space and time, and so it cannot be in a statue or anywhere else. But it's being used as a medium of communication, a medium of interaction, I might say, even more than occasion. To view it as idolatry is, in fact, kind of a misunderstanding of what's going on there. But it's important because it also shows that the Neoplatonists were not as dualistic as we normally think of Platonism to be. Especially the Neoplatonists understood the entire material world to be an emanation from these first principles. And right. So that the material world was infused with the divine. And so you could use things in the material world, such as a statue, such as incense, such as
a seashell.
All of these things as a way of literally connecting with a particular divine energy. Mm-hmm. And so it was in that sense a very non-dual kind of understanding of the universe.
I guess in this context, I suppose I don't see a problem with imagining this kind of primordial dualisms. I think what gets us into trouble is when we start prioritizing or emphasizing one as more valuable or preferable than the other, which I think is what often happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think this is, you know, something that, which I value in the neo-pagan community, broadly speaking, is a valuation of the earth, of embodied life and the natural world. I find that very compatible with Neoplatonism as well. So this is the problem, I think, for modern people is, on one hand, we have the scientific worldview, which
everyone is indoctrinated into from a very early age.
Exactly. And it has a lot of value to it. Yeah. And then we have these religious traditions, which are talking about another realm altogether, which is often considered to be, to some extent, disconnected from the material world, or at least the two pictures don't fit together very well. Then how do we bring those two together? Can we use our understanding of the non-material world, the incorporeal world, to help us to live better here? I mean, again, the Neoplatonic view is that as part of this emanation process, human beings are part of the demiurgy, the creation of the material world. And so how can we do that better, you know? Mm-hmm. And understanding us as part of this process, this emanation, is part of what helps us to do that better. And again, that's what the ancient philosophers were trying to do, is teach you how to essentially embody our own divine selves in a better way or a more consistent way with what they are. And that's what these spiritual practices then intend to do, both on an individual level and then, of course, on a larger level as well.
Staying with the one. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I have this right, just as I guess as a point of clarity. Is it right to say that the one is as much a material as it is a psychic or mental reality? Or what would you say about that?
Well, of course, it's by definition difficult to say. But I would say it is the ultimate, it's a principle. It's the ultimate principle of unity. And so in that sense, anything that is something partakes of that principle, participates in it, you might say, in a Platonic sense, although not literally, because it's really beyond the forms. And so in that sense, it's behind physical reality. The one would be there even if there were no humans to think about it. But it's also, it's there for us as a universal principle, but it also has an image within us. And so this is, it's sometimes called the one within.
Okay.
And so within our psyches, there are images of all of the gods, you know, including the monad and the indefinite dyad and the ineffable one, which can be reached by essentially contemplative processes. We can touch it. And I think that that's what we normally do is when somebody like Plotinus is having an experience of being united with the one, that's happening through the image of the one in his individual psyche, because that's what we have direct access to is our own psyche. And that's what these spiritual practices teach us to do. But because it's an image of the original one, if I could put it that way, it is putting us in a kind of contact with it.
So there's almost an analogous relationship there, right? Because I thought it was interesting that you're saying how a lot of times when we hear about, you know, God or the ideas or the forms, you know, it's something very far removed. But it's interesting to think about this as something interior to our being as well, that we partake of that reality. I think that's helpful.
Yeah, again, it's this idea of images, you know, that lower levels tend to be images of the higher levels. So within our individual soul, if you want to put it that way, or our psyche, we have images of these higher level, I would say. Although, you know, the terminology, the higher, lower is it can be a misleading terminology, but these more abstract or more universal principles, we have images in our individual selves of these more fundamental structures.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about theurgy a bit? I mean, we just kind of alluded to it.
Sure.
I'll just leave the question there. Tell us about theurgy.
Okay. So theurgy, my one phrase definition of theurgy is sacred magic. So the term theurgy was coined by a father and son team, both named Julian the Chaldean and his son Julian the Theurgist, sometime in the second or third century. One thing that means when you understand what theurgy is, you realize it was being done long before them. Again, I would argue it goes back at least to Pythagoras within the Western tradition, and arguably back much further than that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's antecedents going all the way back, right?
Yeah. So they invented this term, and it you can translate it as divine action. I usually contrast it with theology, which is divine talk. So theology is talking about the gods. Theurgy is interacting with the gods in some fashion. So these are spiritual practices that in some sense are supposed to put you in direct interaction with the gods. Well, what are they? Well, one of them I mentioned before is what in later terminology people would call animating a statue, which was invoking a deity into some sort of sacred image. It could be an icon, like in a Greek Orthodox church, for example, or a statue, like in the ancient temples, or some other kind of image. There were various ways of connecting up with the deity you wanted and essentially tuning it. So let me back up a little bit. All the different kinds of theurgy, and there are a number of practices that I'll mention in a few minutes.
Sorry, is prayer a form of theurgy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, the Neoplatonists wrote quite a bit about prayer and how it works. But all of these forms of theurgy make use of this process of emanation that I talked about. So what they said was that, you've got the gods up there, okay, different gods, Apollo or Athena, say, I'll pick as examples. And they emanate lower level spirits, daimones or daimons in ancient Greek. Which really just means lower order spirits. Angels, angeloi, were just a class of daimones. They were the messengers, so to speak. And so you've got these lower level spirits, and then all of the stuff in the material world. And these lines of emanation were called serai, series or chains or cords, or all different ways you could translate it. And so, for example, the lineage, I'll use that terminology, the lineage of Apollo included the sun. It included various things on Earth that were considered solar. So like sunflowers, for example, because they turn towards the sun. Roosters, because they crow at dawn. And gemstones that have a solar appearance to them. So this is where the sort of the more magical aspect comes in. These were all considered symbols of this god. So why is this important? Because from the perspective of theurgy, the gods are out of space and out of time. So you can't call a god to come to you. The gods are everywhere. They're omnipresent. But what you can do is tune your psyche to a particular divine energy. The analogy is it's just like tuning a radio. The radio waves are all around us. They're there all of the time. But you can tune your radio to a particular frequency, and then you can hear or speak, for that matter, on that frequency. And so the idea of theurgy is the theurgist is tuning their mind to a particular divine energy. And you use symbols to do that, symbols associated with that god. Now, some of those would be considered inherent to the god, and others are more cultural. If you're doing this with animating a statue, what you would do is the statue would be an image of the god depicted in a traditional way. So Apollo might have his bow and arrows or a lyre that he would be holding, because these were traditional symbols of Apollo. And you could also then put in the statue or under the statue, for example, various substances that were associated with Apollo. So again, maybe gemstones that had a solar type of appearance to them.
Yeah, they have like these, I guess you would say sympathies, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. So our word symbol comes from the ancient Greek symbolon, which means essentially the same thing. So synthema was another word that meant about the same thing. So these were things connected with the god that would be used. So those are material, and this is, again, what the sort of the non-dualistic aspect. These are material things that are associated with the god and would be considered a way of connecting with the god. So that was one operation, is animating a statue. And when the statue is animated, then you could speak to it, and it would respond to you through the medium of your imagination, which was not considered a falsifying imagination. You know, we think of imaginary as being false. Well, they understood the imagination as being a faculty of the soul between the rational soul and the lower parts of the soul, where the sense organs actually got filtered through the imagination. The imagination was housed in our ethereal body, and the gods were also understood to have an ethereal body, at least some of the gods were. And so this was the natural medium of communication between embodied humans and these kind of disembodied or barely embodied spirits. So you had to train the imagination so that you had accurate communication with the gods. Another operation was called the systasis, or conjunction, or joining, or meeting, or liaison. I think I translated in the book. And this is where you would invoke a god, not into a statue, but just into your presence, and communicate with them through the medium of your imagination and interact with them. Ask them questions, of course, get directions from them, have arguments with them, you know, and in general, get information. It was also possible, another theoretical operation was to draw, and I say, again, I'm using these spatial metaphors, draw God into another person who would operate as a medium. Usually they used a young child as a medium. And then you could interact with that person speaking for the god. And then it was just straight contemplation. So this is what Plotinus did, you know, very much a kind of a Buddhist type of meditation, where they would just go into themselves and try and essentially sink down to the level of a particular god, or all the way to the ineffable one, which was, you know, a very challenging process by this sort of pure meditation. So theurgy, this is why I call it sacred magic. It used a lot of the techniques of traditional magic, which they wouldn't have called it magic. Because again, magic had a religious meaning to it. Magia was the sacred rituals, you know, thinking of sort of the Persian magoi or magi. They would have called traditional magic, you know, to get a lover or to win at the chariot races or something like that. That was goes. Or goetheia, Goethe would be a sorcerer, we might say. Goetheia was sort of sorcery, which is not necessarily doing evil, but, you know, for just sort of material purposes. You're not particularly interested in any sort of sacred end or religious end. You're just
it's almost divorced from a spiritual path in a sense, right? It's more just like there's a pure utility to that kind of operation, right?
Exactly. And so theurgy is more where you're interested in the gods, and it may be to make your life better, you know, but it's not sort of strictly materialistic, I guess I would say. Now, obviously, when you start trying to draw a hard line, it gets difficult. Okay, it's sort of a false dichotomy, but they saw these sort of two different motivations, I guess, behind these practices. But a lot of the practices were, in fact, they're not very well documented because they were mostly taught orally and taught personally. Mm-hmm. But we can understand them by looking at the more strictly magical, you know, low magic, it might be called now, for instance, the Greek magical papyri. You say, oh, yeah, we can see what they're doing. We can see how to animate a statue, for example, or to call a deity into some sort of interaction with us. Dream incubation was another theurgical activity. It goes back, at least to Pythagoras. So people would go into caves or into temples, and after doing a ritual, asking the god to have a significant dream, they would have a dream.
Those are often accompanied by entheogens, as I understand, right?
Yeah. So an interesting question on all of these practices is how much did they use entheogens? And we really don't know, because again, that was not something that was spoken about a lot or written down. It seems like a lot of the Neoplatonic stuff was not chemically enhanced, you might say, but we really don't know, you know, using the plant spirits to enhance the experiences or to trigger the experiences, I think was, something that was well known in the Mediterranean world.
Yeah. But in terms of those people who practice theurgic rites, as you mentioned, there's different reasons why people would do that, different sort of ends in mind, right? But I guess for some, the ultimate goal was theosis, right? Mm-hmm. Or
deification. Yeah.
Deification, becoming one with the one, or some, however you want to put that. And that made me think about, you know, sometimes Christianity is called, Platonism for the masses. And I wonder what you think about that. But one of the things that occurred to me is that, you know, if for the Pythagorean initiate, if the ultimate goal is union with the one through this, you know, means of mystical ascent, one of the things that I think is unique about Christianity, you know, almost similar to how chaos magic is like a stripped back or vulgarized or simplified version of like more elaborate ceremonial magic. Mm-hmm. Christianity, I think, tries to take this idea of atonement or becoming one and vulgarizing it, basically, right? Like, you don't need to come to us. You don't need to do all this crazy stuff. You know, God will come to you, and all you have to do is accept Jesus in your heart. And I realize in saying that that's like very reductive, but I guess my question is, do you think there's some truth to that idea that Christianity is kind of a vulgarized theurgy?
Well, yes, there is some truth to that. I would say, and you know, I try not to badmouth Christianity too much when I talk about it, but I mean, you know, basically what happened was the early Christians discovered that they didn't have any sort of decent philosophy behind their religion, so they had to try and come up with one. And so they borrowed pieces of the dominant theology of the time, which was Neoplatonism. And so there's certainly a very definite element of Platonism in Christianity. Now, there are a number of important differences, I think. One of them is it's actually much more dualistic. You know, there's earth, which is evil, you know, to some extent, not to be valued in any case. And then there's heaven, where we all want to go. And as you said, there's not any difficult spiritual practices that are necessary to have a genuine religious experience. And I've had, you know, Christian religious people talk to me about this, because they say, why is everyone leaving our church? I was like, well, because nobody has a religious experience. They go there and they have a lecture, you know, a lecture about either kind of rather banal morality or politics, you know, and that's just not what they're looking for when they participate in a religion. They're not having an experience of God, whatever you think it is. So they tried to make it a religion for the masses, and it doesn't work very well. And I think, you know, we find it being repurposed for all sorts of other political and other purposes over the centuries. And it's not really satisfying many people's real religious needs. And, you know, it provided a worldview for a long time, but now the scientific worldview works much better, you know?
Right.
And so it doesn't even provide that anymore. So I think, you know, now all that said, I mean, there are Christian traditions where there is a stronger theurgical element. And I think, you know, some of the monastic traditions, some of the Orthodox traditions have retained more of the theurgical practices, again, repackaged and put it in a Christianized form. But for the people that are willing to, you know, do the work, that it's probably still accessible. But I, to my mind, there's some fundamental things ontologically wrong about it, and psychologically wrong about it even more so, that I think causes them to be not as good as say, a Neoplatonic neo-paganism.
Yeah.
So in particular, let me just mention one of them before I forget. One of them is it's monotheistic, you know? And one of the values of, I think, polytheistic religions, especially as understood through Neoplatonism, is you do have all of these different gods, and they're all doing different things, and they've got different interests, different offices, if you like, that they're involved in. That, I think, is a very important psychological perspective. We do have all of these different images of these gods in our psyches that are trying to get us to do different things that's important for us to do. When you've got a monotheistic religion, you've got one God, and if you suppose that God is good, then that God has to be all of the good, and then that creates the polar opposite of some sort of Satan or all evil thing. And that then just invites projection of this evil on anyone who disagrees with you. So I think the fact that monotheism forces people sort of psychologically to make this split is really a pernicious thing on the individual level, but then also on the social and the political level as well.
I think that's a really important insight. And I wish more people were able to recognize the descent or lineage of secularism from Christianity, and what you're describing in terms of politics, you know, makes a lot of sense when you see what's going on. And I like the way that the whole issue of theodicy gets reframed in more polytheistic context, right? Because it's less amenable to demonizing a particular other, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And it also gives you greater insight into your own motivations as well, you know.
Right. With the understanding that we're kind of, you know, comprised of these multiplicity of sometimes conflicting drives and so on, right?
Let me actually mention one other thing. I'll try and make it brief. Another way I think Christianity gets it wrong is their notion of Jesus as a deified is pretty good. And I think especially in the early Christian traditions, the non-canonical traditions, he's a very interesting figure, very much like Pythagoras. I mean, different in doctrine, of course, but I would say, yeah, Jesus was the Son of God. So is Pythagoras.
Right. You know? Well, so is Caesar, by the way, but yeah. Let's not go there.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, genuinely speaking, I would, we all embody divinity. I think that's part of the Neoplatonic view. So in a sense, we are all descendants of the gods. Some people manifest it much more directly than others. And those are the ones we tend to think of as the great spiritual leaders and spiritual founders. So Pythagoras would be one. And that's why some people said he was a son of Apollo. But in some sense, you know, this is the notion that we all can become deified by better expressing our divine nature, I mean, that's sort of our role, just like you've got these various ranks of gods and down through the celestial gods and the daimonos that are all sort of more closer to the material world. And then you've got us, you know, which are embodied. We're physically embodied, but we still are also emanations of this this first principle and the other gods. And what we're really trying to do, what deification means, you know, Plato said becoming gods so far as possible for people, you know, and so that's what we're trying to learn how to do, is how we can become a better embodiment of these divine principles.
And I know you started off with a critique of Christianity, and I'm not sure that you landed it, but I'm going to pick up on that thread anyway. And I think this is one of the interesting things about Christianity, for all its faults. You know, it is innovative in the way that it sort of reverses that idea of theosis. Like, no. It's not that you have to become divine. And it's not so much that, how do I say this? So divinity becomes humanity, right? And so it kind of troubles the whole, in my view, the whole dichotomy. So to say that the ultimate goal of a spiritual path is to become God is as much to say it's to become fully human, right? And I think there's an interesting way in which Christianity, almost in spite of itself, troubles that distinction in an interesting and sometimes helpful way that isn't always appreciated. I wanted to return to this bit on cybernetics. There's this one section towards the end of the book here where you're talking about the esoteric elements. Mm-hmm. And there's a little subheading here called Air the Governor. And I'll just read it because I think it's interesting. The aerial body's connection to the nervous system reminds us that because air is moist and warm, it has the power of flexible discrimination. Therefore, air is associated with information and communication as an active principle. Air is associated with computing. The aerial spirit role as a subtle and visible governing faculty was recognized in ancient times. For example, Diogenes of Apollonia says, "It seems to me that which has intelligence is what people call air, and that all people are steered," and then you have this term that I'm not sure how you say, it's like kubernastai or something? Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
They're steered by this, and that it has power over all things. For the very thing seems to be a god, and to reach everywhere, and to dispose all things, and to be in everything. And then parenthetically, it's significant that the word he uses for steered, kubernastai, is related to kubernetikos, meaning skilled in steering or guiding, which is the origin of our term cybernetics, referring to the principles of intelligence and governance in animals and machines. Air is the cybernetic element. I'm really interested in questions that relate to spirituality and technology. And I think these are becoming more relevant questions today. You know, there's more and more discussion about AI, and questions about intelligence, consciousness are becoming a little bit more mainstream. I just wondered, you know, you have a background, as you mentioned, in computation. I wonder if this is something that you've given some thought to. I'd just love to hear where you are on this kind of issue.
Yeah, well, we probably don't have enough time, but I mean, I sometimes call computer science applied Platonism, because if you think about what a computer scientist does, a program is an abstract object. It's a mathematical object. And what the program does is it's a mathematical relationship. It's all out of space and out of time. And, you know, when we do mathematics about computer programming, we're doing mathematics. It's timeless. But what does a computer scientist do? Well, we have this machine, which is kind of like pure matter in the sense that it's just a bunch of bits. And then we impose this form, which is the abstract program, on this essentially indeterminate matter. Now, of course, there's a lot of structure there. It's not real indeterminate, but relatively indeterminate. And so the program becomes embodied in the computer. And then the computer does something. It behaves in some way. Well, that sounds awfully Platonic to me. We've got these abstract forms that exist outside of space and time. They can be used to organize some sort of relatively unorganized matter, then the matter behaves in some way. And I'm forgetting which philosopher it was that said the soul is a moving number, you know? So the soul is what brings the forms, is what brings the forms into manifestation in space and time. So he could have essentially been describing a computer program. Okay, it's a moving number. You put the abstract structure into this material, and then the material does stuff. That's my picture of embodied intelligence, in particular our embodied intelligence. We've got all of these abstract structures in our brains that are then governing the way we think and speak and talk. And of course, AI is just the same thing, except it's not a biological stuff we're embodying it in. It's some other more technological stuff. So I think it's all very Platonic. And I think, you know, that there's in principle no reason why a machine couldn't have a soul, if I use that term, that's just as real as ours, just embodied in a different kind of stuff. You know, and even in principle, people talk about uploading our brains to the cloud and then perhaps downloading it into some sort of artificial thing. Well, I think there's a lot of practical impediments to that, but I don't see any theoretical reason why that couldn't be done.
I agree with that. I happen to think it's a terrible idea, though. Like when I imagine what hell is like, that's kind of one of the first places my mind goes to. Because I think there's a certain salvific quality in death. But that
doesn't
just
go on forever.
But that's just kind of my more pessimistic outlook on things. But something in there made me think about the simulation hypothesis. Do you give any credence to that sort of thing? I mean, it seems plausible.
I don't know if I'd go so far as plausible. I don't see a metaphysical reason to disbelieve it, but I just don't really see any reason to believe it over lots of other things that I don't believe.
Yeah,
I will tell you, though, that I'm very interested in what's sometimes called the mathematical universe hypothesis. And, you know, the one question is, if you think of all of these mathematical objects, which are Platonic forms, some of them happen to be instantiated in our universe, the basic fundamental laws of physics, whatever they are, whether we got them right now or not, I don't know. But whatever they are, they're instantiated in our universe. But the other question is, well, why those? Why those particular laws and not some other laws? So one hypothesis is, well, maybe all mathematical structures essentially generate a material reality that goes with them. Now, for many universes, it would be very uninteresting, or they may not be the sort of universes that generate intelligence. Ours happens to be the sort that generates intelligence. Maybe every mathematical system you can think of, there is a universe that goes with it.
Yeah, it's kind of a Platonic rendering of the multiverse in an interesting way.
Exactly.
I would love to pick up this conversation again with you at some point in the future. Right now, though, I have to go pick up my son from school.
Well, that's important too.
So I've got to cut things short, but it was fantastic talking to you. I really appreciate it. I guess I should say, the book that we've been referring to quite a bit is Pythagorean Theology and the Esoteric Elements, and you can get it on Amazon. I'm sure you can get it other places too. It was relatively inexpensive and a great introduction to this topic that is, well, esoteric. Is there anything that you want to leave people with in terms of how to get in touch, what, or anything else?
Yeah, I think my website is opsopaus.com. That's opsopaus.com. And you can find out information there about all my books and, you know, contact me through that as well. I'm also on Facebook, but probably the website is the best way to get in touch with me and to find out, get access to, you know, I don't know, 40 some odd years of writings that I've been putting up on the web. I would love to hear from you too. So if you're interested in any of this stuff.
Every author's dream is to wake up and there's an email saying, I read your book. It meant so much to me.
Exactly.
All right, well, thanks again. Let's keep in touch.
Okay, good.
Thanks, John. Thank you. Bye.